In partnership with the Lilly Fellows Program, the Institute of Communication and Religion at Seton Hall is proud to present a follow-up to Communication and Religion in the 2020 Election Conference. Join four of the speakers as they discuss what happened in the 2020 election and what these events say about the future in communication and religion.
Hello to our listeners. This is the Seton Hall Institute for Communication and Religion. My name is Jasmine DeLeon, and I will be your host for today's episode. I am excited to introduce Dr. John Radwin, an Associate Professor of Communication and the Director of the Institute for Communication and Religion at Seton Hall University. His teaching and research focus on the intersection of rhetoric and religion, specifically examining how ancient traditions influence contemporary public discourse. Dr. John Radwin organized the Seton Hall Institute for Communication and Religion Conference on the intersection of faith, politics, and rhetoric on the 2020 U.S. presidential election. We're here to follow up with him on religious discourse and politics during 2021, and now we are here to follow up with him on the religious discourse and politics during 2021, and now. Dr. Radwin, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Jasmine. It's a real pleasure to be here. Right at the outset, I want to send out a few thank yous. First, I'd like to thank the Lilly Fellows Program in Humanities and the Arts for funding all of our work on rhetoric, religion, and politics. And then I'd also like to thank our associate producer for this series, Kai De Jesus.
So, taking a look back on the 2020 election and the Communication and Religion Conference, what are some theories that stood out to you the most?
First off, I teach communication theory, and one thing I want everybody to understand is what a theory is. So theories are explanations, and sometimes they're pretty big explanations, so they're considered master narratives. What they're not is laws. Theories are not 100% dependable in every scenario. And in communication especially, we have many, many more theories than we have laws. So we should use theories to explain and figure out what's going on, but we should also question them and refine them and use them to get closer to the truth. So when I look back at our last conference in the midst of a very difficult election, the 2020 election, Dr. Polito talked about ideology theory and false consciousness. In general, when I first started learning about that theory, I didn't like the idea of false consciousness. I didn't want anybody telling me that my consciousness was not true, that I was in a fantasy land. But more and more when I look at contemporary public discourse, especially around vaccine mandates and associated political policies, and also around some of the election disputes, it's hard not to toward false consciousness, where people have ideas that don't match up with reality and refuse to acknowledge that mismatch. And then my personal favorite theory from the last conference was when Dr. Arnett spoke about Dorothy Day and her ethic of immediate care. Dorothy Day is someone who's been considered for sainthood right now. She did amazing charity work through the 20th century and started the Catholic worker movement. And so her solution to political problems is deeply spiritual. The basic angle on it is a very, very Christian angle where you get physically involved. So Christian communication, especially according to Dorothy Day, involves immediate aid. And so she started houses of hospitality and soup kitchens, and she was also an activist and a protester for causes she believed in. And so speaking and showing up is an important step in society become more just.
So Dorothy Day was a journalist, and just to go along with that, I wanted to ask, what is the role of journalism in influencing this political discourse?
Right. So the role of journalism is giant. It's immense. It was always important. So as journalism is growing up, especially in England, it's considered the fourth estate through the 1700s. It's a social power right next to the power of the clergy and the power of the lords and the power of the commoners. And then, you know, in the American context, our country grows up right along with journalism. And in the 20th century, journalists, and especially news organizations, functioned as gatekeepers, so they would control relatively, what information got to the public, and they had relatively high standards for what the public should be made aware of. And then now we're in the 21st century, where we have social media. And in that sense, the journalism slash news, political slash religious public sphere is a free-for-all, where everybody is sharing their views and everybody gets to be a gatekeeper. Everybody just gets to make their own decisions about what they post to the public sphere. And so that chaos can be overwhelming. In a certain sense, I do appreciate it. It's, in my view, better to have more voices. It just, on the other side, it puts more responsibility on the receiver that they need to, you know, overall learn to think critically and analyze arguments and news. And then beyond that, if you become a media critic, or you become 21st century media literate. And so a lot of that means being able to take a critical eye to the news you receive, and especially to understand the importance of journalistic pluralism, where it's a mistake to stop your search for truth at one story. And it's another mistake to stop your search for truth with one source, with many stories from one source. And unfortunately, lots of people fall into that pattern. It's easy to just stick in your echo chamber and listen to the source or small set of sources that tells you what you want to hear. And so a good consumer of news in the 21st century has to step up their game and actively search out diverse voices to begin to learn what's going on. Our world is very complex, especially the media sphere is complex, and pluralism is the first step toward figuring out that complexity.
To also kind of build on that idea of the news is so widespread, and it's not always controllable, especially when a lot of young people, I can speak for myself, and even older people get a lot of their news from social media. And that was a big part of the 2020 election. That was a big part of what happened in the January 6th Capitol riots. So how did technology and social media affect the election, and how are these effects still present today?
The obvious one is bans, right? So President Trump losing platform access is, in my view, just. When you continually abuse platform rules, there are consequences. And there is an important distinction to be made there, and it's not just with Trump, it's coming up with the Rogan controversy right now. There's a big difference between government censorship and private companies making decisions about what they want on their platforms. And so right now with government censorship, we're seeing things like moves to ban books in school libraries. That's miles different from a private company deciding what content they're going to allow on their platform. And then, so the results have been the growth of more platforms, right? So if you get banned from one platform and you've got resources and people who are on your side, go ahead and start your own platform and try to compete. And so that goes back to the free-for-all idea that I was mentioning before. I personally welcome a range of voices. So I understand when one platform doesn't want a misinformative or divisive voice on their platform, but that doesn't mean that you can't go out and be an entrepreneur and start your own channel, as it were, to get your views out there. So there's more to it, but the short bit is I personally welcome public pressure on companies to get them in line with public values. And I also personally welcome, once somebody feels like they've been pushed out of one platform, if you want to go somewhere else, I say, go for it. It's your right. It's a free country, and freedom of speech is an important value. And then again, it's a very different issue than when the government is shutting you down. So a school taking a book out of a library is a different zone of freedom of speech restricting that.
I'd say that I understand that government versus private regulation of what content can be disseminated to the public is different, but I'd also say that a lot of social media conglomerates like Meta, Facebook, they have so much power today. I mean, they don't just influence the kind of news that people get and the way that people get their news, but they are a big source of information. So do you think that it is justifiable to keep everyone to the same standard with censoring people on social platforms, especially when the whole point of those platforms is to give a voice to everybody, like you said before, too?
Yeah, well, again, when it's private, the company itself decides what the point is. And so a good way to think about this is to do a little bit of media history. When we go back to the 20th century, we're dealing with radio and TV for the broadcast media. And the public airwaves belong to everybody. That's at least how our country decided to work it out, is to say that frequencies are a state resource. They're a country resource, and they can be leased out to radio stations. They can be leased out to TV networks. And so that gave companies, private companies, a lot more governmental pressure, because what they were working on, they didn't own. The people owned the airwaves. And that's the major shift I see as we head into the 21st century, is the people or the government doesn't own the operating necessity for the social media platform. The it's private. And so like the transitional period in 20th century media was the cable revolution, when TV stations went off of the public airwaves and onto privately owned wires, cables, linked between homes. So that was like kind of the first step of, whoa, the government is not as in as much control as we thought it was. And now we're really seeing that bloom nowadays with 21st century media. So it's not that we shouldn't have communication laws. We certainly should have communication laws. And then I would start to say, well, in many ways, we really already do. So if we come back to politics and disputes between parties, slander, and libel laws are still there. And so right now, with the debate over the election validity and the voting machines, there's ongoing defamation suits against folks who are saying that the machines are inherently corrupt and were skewing the election. And that's a very good thing. Super happy about that. We've got, in my opinion, many, many good communication laws. We could have more, and we should keep working on it. But mostly it comes in the will to apply those laws, and that's a political will, right? A political leader has to step up and take a chance either to bring the suit when they think their rights have been violated, or to defend the truth.
Just like kind of along the idea of communication laws, I think a big criticism among different experts of technology and social media is that the Communications Decency Act doesn't do enough to protect people. So do you have any comments, or what do you think about that?
Once you start enforcing that type of stuff, you start to get into dangers with censorship. So other people arbitrating decency is, including the government, is dangerous territory, in my opinion. I lean more toward freedom of speech, including indecent speech, because standards of decency, yes, they are community standards. And really, this is what I think the platforms are taking over. They're coming up with their own standards of decency for their privately owned platform. And when those are enforced well, it tends to go better. And when those are weakly enforced, yes, society is harmed, but also at a certain point, the company starts getting harmed. And so that's some of what's going on with Spotify right now, where Spotify stock is suffering. And when that economic pressure is put on by the public, companies respond.
Like on the same line of decency, I think a lot of people would agree that in our government, and even just today, there is divisive rhetoric all around. What do you think about this? And what are some solutions that you can propose?
All right. So first off, yes, some pundits are even discussing civil war right now. and I would encourage everybody to study our Civil War. We already had one. It was horrific, with more deaths than you can imagine. And so Civil War is an ultimate failure of communication, where we start to revert to an animal level of solving problems with violence rather than a human level of solving problems with discourse, with rhetoric, with argumentation and advocacy. So when I look back through history, I'm not the only person who does this, these problems are not new. Other democracies have faced them. And so our own country faced a civil war. There was obviously divisive rhetoric leading right into it, especially divisive rhetoric over human rights and who can own who else. When we go way back in history to the ancient Greeks, they're on top of this. So for Plato and for Aristotle, the goal of society, the goal for Athens, is eudaimonia. It's good spirit. It's unified spirit. It's everybody together. And the opposite of that is not like bad spirit or evil spirit or indecent spirit, like we were talking before. Instead, the opposite of good spirit is divisive spirit, disdemonia. So when you're breaking the whole, it's a problem. It's the bottom. It's that step that takes you toward that animal solution of violence. And then, so that's the Greek tradition. In the Christian tradition, another ancient tradition with lots of relevant teaching, the vision for social structures is one of integral relation. So the church is considered like a body. It's the mystical body of Christ. It's a unified whole. And so like division within a body is kind of obviously counterproductive. It's like one hand trying to fight the other hand, or one hand trying to punch the head. And so self-harm is illogical and clearly damaging and something that we should work to try to avoid. So in the Christian tradition of organic unity, the goal is for everybody to recognize that they have a place, that they are part of the whole. And then, a little bit contrary to modern visions of democracy, it's not every part has a voice. Not every part is the head. Not every part is making the decision. And that's okay. It's appropriate for the hand to do hand things. It's appropriate for the tongue to do tongue things. And it's appropriate for the brain to do brain things. And when they're all unified, when they're all working together, that's a successful organic social structure, at least according to the Christian tradition.
As an expert in rhetoric and religion, how have the ancient ideals you just talked about of media, religion, and politics, how do they influence the political discourse today?
Right. So a lot of what I think they do and a lot of what I hope they can do is give us vocabulary, give citizens vocabulary for unpacking rhetoric. And so Plato is at the root of rhetorical theory. He's the first person who's taking public discourse in a democracy seriously, and he's got a lot to teach us. So one of the first things he would say is always remember that people, human beings, are spiritual beings, that we have souls. And so when you're speaking to people, it's very, very different than speaking to an animal. And the part that you're addressing is not the animal part. It's not the body. You're addressing the spiritual part. You're addressing the soul. And so if you treat your audience as anything less than a divine being, a spiritual being, you're getting into a major moral failure. So for what Plato would call sophistic rhetoric, for rhetoric that's self-serving and putting self over others, tactics that go with that tend to be things like lies and trickery, where you're treating your audience not as a spiritual being that's deserving of divine reverence and care. Instead, you're treating your audience as a dupe, as somebody to be tricked, that you're better than them. And so that's Plato's ethic. And so it starts to be really quickly easy to interpret maybe not super easy, but it starts to be easy to unpack the ethics of our leaders and our public figures and their voices. When they're caring about us, they're on a good moral track. And when they're advancing self-agendas, their own agendas, over us, they're treating us as less than a soul. Another important thing to take from Plato is his metaphor for the communication itself, the messages. And so Plato's metaphor is known as the pharmacological metaphor. So it's a drug or medicine metaphor. And then he also uses a food metaphor. So the Greeks, similar to the Christians, think in organic terms. So the polis, the public, is like a living body. And as you give it messages, as you feed it messages, they have super strong impacts. So that's the drug metaphor, is when you put a message out there, it has the potential to heal or to harm. So the good rhetor, the good speaker, is somebody who's studied the audience and studied the truth and knows what truths they need to hear at what times to get them on the right track. And then the rhetor that is, again, sophistic, that doesn't care about the polis, that cares about themselves, they introduce their rhetoric, and again, it's a drug or a food that harms the audience. So again, the caring rhetor is somebody who knows that public discourse has power, the power to poison the public mind or the power to heal the public minds. And the ethical ones, of course, are trying to maintain and restore society, not knock it down, not divide it, not kill it. And so that a little bit comes back to the communication laws I was talking about. It puts some limits on what we can feed the public. In the biblical tradition, communication is really very, very physical. And so Jesus is not a writer. Jesus is a speaker. And Jesus travels, and he doesn't just speak, he also heals. He lays on hands, and he's also very humble and washes feet. It's a very clear ethic of care on an interpersonal level. And so in the Christian tradition, it's called incarnational, where you're physically there in your body. And so bodies themselves are important, and it's important to care for one another's bodies. So Pope Francis, in his recent encyclical Fratelli Tutti, spends a whole chapter on the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan is Pope Francis's model for all human communication and relationships, from the micro level of one-on-one communication all the way up to relations between nation states. The overall idea is when someone needs help, you don't hesitate, you give it, and you give it physically, and you make a long-term commitment. So in the parable of the Good Samaritan, the foreigner, the Samaritan, helps out the person, the victim, leading on the side of the road physically, gets down and binds wounds himself, doesn't tell anybody else to do it, does it himself, and then secures future care with the innkeeper. And so the encyclical Fratelli Tutti takes that simple story of one-on-one communication and healing and says that that same standard should apply across all levels of communication, so the organizational level and then up through states and governments all the way up to the United Nations.
That kind of nuance that you just described and characterized with Fratelli Tutti and the reading of the Good Samaritan from that Catholic perspective, not everyone, especially like you said, now that everyone can participate in public discourse and share information, not everyone can understand that nuance, especially when not everyone's reading the Fratelli Tutti. So do you think that, like you said, journalism today, even though it's a lot more plural, is equipped to cover the nuances of religion and the nuances of politics?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In general, online media are not depth-oriented. So the metaphor that's sometimes used is the internet is a million miles wide and 1 inch deep. And nuance requires depth. So where do you get depth? probably not online, probably from books and long conversations with friends and so on. And that takes work. It takes time and effort. So for, especially since we talked about Pope Francis before, for Vatican media, the Vatican has always been a leader in journalism. Ever since there's been modern journalism, there's been news output from the Vatican City-State. And so, of course, early on, it was newspapers. As we hit the 20th century, Vatican Radio is the first international radio station. And as each new communication medium got developed through the 20th century, the Catholic leadership is right there, developing it and using it to disseminate both truth, the news, and spiritual teaching. And that still goes on today in the 21st century. So VaticanNews.va is the Pope's website, the Vatican website. They do journalism, they do news, in some sense, like everybody else, so the stories are relatively short. In other ways, I want to say they're doing a great job because they translate their stories into sometimes dozens of languages, so they're making sure the spiritual teaching and truth, solid journalism, is reaching as many people as possible. And then on top of that, the Vatican News site has prominent links to Pope Francis's teaching and encyclicals, and those are longer. They take more work to interpret. But in comparison to past years, they are more accessible, right? So if I want to read an encyclical in 1940, I probably have to go to a library or maybe a specialized bookstore and buy it and do the work to interpret it. Today, there are, again, prominent links on the Vatican VA site that take you to the actual Vatican site where there's all the encyclicals and really all the other public discourse from church leaders. And they're long and they're texty, but they are accessible and so translated into many languages, publicly available and advertised. So if you want nuance in especially Christian doctrine, but really for encyclicals and especially for Fratelli Tutti, it's called social teaching. It's Pope Francis trying to help society understand a better path or a path closer to ethical being together. And so it's there. And then I'd say the other part of it too is because of the social media explosion, we can do podcasts like this one where somebody who has read Fratelli Tutti can sit down and discuss it with whoever would like to tune in for about a half an hour. And I'll give you the high points of it, like I just did, a wonderful chapter on the Parable of the Good Samaritan and lots of social teaching about how to improve politics and improve journalism. One of my favorite lines from Pope Francis, it's not in Fratelli Tutti, it's from an earlier document from the 2018 World Communications Day speech. Pope Francis calls for journalism for peace. It's journalism with an agenda. And that sounds wrong. That sounds like journalism is biased or something like that. And that's not his perspective at all. It's no, journalism is something that can make peace happen because when people know the truth, they know what's actually going on and they can make better decisions rather than being manipulated and duped. Human freedom is advanced as humans learn more about the truth. So it's a very high standard for journalists, but it's one we can meet. It's one that we can strive for. It's, again, that goal of truth and light that will help us with lots of our problems.
Wow, that was really interesting. So VaticanNews.va and social teaching, I'll definitely check that out. So that is all the time that we have for today. It has been a pleasure, Dr. Radman. Thank you all for listening and stay tuned for more episodes. I'm your guest host, Jasmine DeLeon, signing off.
This follow-up to the College of Communication and Religion's 2020 conference is hosted by Jasmine DeLeon and Joaquim Matamas and produced by Kai DeJesus. The college would also like to thank the Lilly Fellows Program for their contributions and you for listening.